feel like to take some time at the end of every period of meditation to open it up for any questions or comments. So the floor is open. So tonight I'm continuing a part of a weekly series that's going to be ongoing for the next several weeks and months and well into the year on the core teachings of the Buddha, where this practice of insight meditation originates, is attributed to Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, 2600 years ago. The Buddhist practice was much more than just a contemplative, just a formal sitting meditation practice. It was a path of practice, a pragmatic approach to how we live and engage in the world. And this was taught through the framework of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. I have some differences of opinion on the translations of the Four Noble Truths and what that means, but we'll hopefully unpack some of that as the weeks go on. Tonight I'm doing a second part of discussion on this first truth or first noble truth that the Buddha taught of dukkha, is the Pali Sanskrit word. And so I won't recap a whole lot because we talked about it last week, but to give some context for the folks that weren't here last week, is that, you know, The truth of dukkha, this first noble truth, was more or less a task rather than a truth. So the Buddha was, in all of his teachings, offering a path of practice, not so much a belief structure. And this is typical of ancient Indian Vedic schools and Brahminic schools and all of the traditions prior to the Buddha and at the time of the Buddha, is that they didn't so much have anything that we know in the West as orthodoxy, which is a belief structure. It was more about, like you hear and see even today, around yoga and asana practice. It was a practice. It was practice-based spirituality, if you even want to call it spirituality. So this truth of dukkha is really an invitation to turn towards, to understand, to embrace, and to be honest about the ways that we experience dissatisfaction, stress, friction, you could go as far to say suffering in our lives. So the Buddha's invitation was to really start to turn towards and to understand the ways and the areas of our lives where we experience stress. And to be honest about that, first and foremost, with ourselves. So when we meditate, as we contemplate, as we take on a contemplative practice of holding something in mind and reflecting, one of the ways and one of the things we're reflecting on very counterintuitively is our own suffering and the dissatisfaction or the stress or the, you know, sticky parts of our lives. And the reason is because the Buddha believed that if we could understand the ways that we experience suffering, we could understand the causes of that suffering for ourselves, and if we understand the causes, then we can find freedom from that suffering. So it's a very personal, individual endeavor. By definition, dukkha is the unsatisfactoriness. This word dukkha means it's the unsatisfactory experience that we have due to the inherent impermanence, the insecure nature, the uncertainty, and the vulnerable nature of our existence. The fact that things change. The fact that we experience loss, that we get older, that our bodies hurt, that we deal with conflict, that we're vulnerable. We're vulnerable to change. And so the dukkha is this kind of the rub of our existence. Buddha defines the term dukkha, and the reason why I like to use that term is because it's not easily translatable into English. It means several things. And so he kind of gives a scope for some of the flavors of this friction, or this stress is maybe a good word for it, that we experience in our lives. And he says, this is dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, death is dukkha. Encountering what is not dear is dukkha. Separation from what is dear is dukkha. Not getting what one wants is dukkha. In short, and it's okay if this part throws you for a loop, he says, in short, clinging to the five aggregates as self is dukkha. So this is the part, this is the piece that I'm going to talk about tonight, is this last part. In short, so kind of he summarizes, clinging to the five aggregates as self is dukkha. So what's meant by that? So tonight's topic's going to be on dukkha, but focus specifically on the idea and the teachings of anatta, or not self, and the Buddhist teaching on the five aggregates. To give some context, one of the ways of looking at the Buddhist teaching is that there are many spiritual forms of practice during the time of the Buddha. The Jains were around, there was a rich Vedic tradition, there were ascetics, there were fire worshippers, there were all sorts of different types of spiritual seekers. It was very common. And so a lot of the languaging that the Buddha used in his teaching is makes more sense if you look at the context of some of the other traditions. Three of the things that were really unique to the Buddha, and we won't talk about all of them, but we're going to talk about two. First of all is the teaching on dependent origination, which I'm not going to talk about tonight, and it really is a key and a very important part of the Buddha's teaching. And there are two other teachings, one on anatta, which is not self, and the teaching of the five aggregates, or the khandhas. So we'll start with a broad overview. Hopefully the Buddhist teaching was meant to be sequential and easily understood, just as I'm sure most of us can understand. Yep, aging's stressful. being parted from what's dear to us is stressful. Losing other people, yeah, we get that, right? So hopefully this teaching has a flavor of that. It's meant to be practical. So a broad overview of the Buddha's teaching on anatta. Maybe a good way to start. And the first principle here is that we all view as human beings, as sentient beings, beings that have consciousness and memory and perception, perceptive awareness. We are able to identify symbols and meaning and words, and right, and having these complex minds that we do. We view the world, our world, often self-referentially, so we make sense of the world because of our place in it. So we have roles, we have occupations, we have relationships, political and social stances, all of these things, and that this is very natural and normal. We're a social species. Some evolutionary biologists would say that the Homo sapiens excelled far greater than the Neanderthals because we worked together. We were social. And so the reason we survived is because we depended upon groups, and we were able to familiarize ourselves with certain groups and to assign tasks and to delegate. And so we are very often, we find ourselves fit into certain roles. One of the biggest roles that we have, of course, in our culture is what we do for work. And it's like the airplane conversation that's pretty typical. You sit down, you ask someone maybe where they're from, so that's another self that we have. Where are you from? So what does that mean when you tell someone where you're from? That could mean a lot of things depending upon their own perceptions. Okay, you're from Tennessee. What does that mean? You know, and then you ask them, what do you do? Well, I'm a social worker, I'm a doctor, I'm a server, I'm a student. Lots of roles, lots of occupations, lots of things, lots of selves. Some of these categories are self in society and culture, so I'm white, I'm female, I'm a person of color, I'm queer, I'm American, I'm liberal, I'm conservative, I'm an immigrant, I'm educated, I'm progressive, I'm upper class, I'm an environmentalist. We have self in community. I'm a recovering person, right? I've been in 12-step recovery for a number of years, so that's a community that myself fits into. I'm a Buddhist. I'm Christian. I'm a felon. I'm a gang member. Membership with different organizations and groups. All of these are ways that we have and fit into communities. We have self in occupation, which we talked about. Self in family, mother, father, grandparent, daughter, adopted, uncle, niece. We have self in relationships, husband, married, single, divorced, widowed. And so social belongingness and the participation in community is an essential thing for human safety, for our empathetic attunement to other people, to develop life meaning and purpose. In the Buddhist teaching on anatta, what anatta means is not self. So the Buddha's not saying that we need to be dismissive or disengaged from our roles or responsibilities. He's instead suggesting that there are maybe a couple themes or things that we should be interested in as these selves and these roles and our occupations and all of our identities take root. And the first theme that he was interested in teaching, the teaching of anatta, is looking at the ways in which we cling, we hold on to, we strive after, we crave for, we have to maintain and cling to the positions or places or roles or occupations and relationships. Because they too are subject to change and loss. So when we identify and we hold really fixed and strongly with a certain role, we often experience the rub, the dukkha, the suffering that comes from that loss. For example, a change of career, getting fired. There's the suffering of just that change, of course, is probably a lot greater than, but there's also the loss of the position, getting demoted, getting transferred. We have empty nest syndrome, right? This is a change of the self over time, is when you have a son or a daughter and they're not quite as young as they once were. They grow up and they develop their own selves and their own identities, and they rebel against yourselves and your identities, and they move into the world and they leave the home, and there's that sense of the motherness or the fatherness changing. We experience breakups, changes in music, from the simple to the more challenging. We experience a lot of identity changes over time. And so what the Buddha is saying with anatta is not that you shouldn't engage with or experience the beauty of some job or some role or some relationship, but that we need to be really careful in allowing that relationship to be fluid, changing. The self is not permanent, the self is constantly in process. Instead, what we do is we do cling, and oftentimes we perceive that these roles will ultimately be fulfilling, and we chase the status of social praise, or we cling to roles to try to keep them around when in fact they're changing. And so the instruction, the practice of anatta is a reflective is an inquiry, is a question about what are some of these roles that I have? What are some of the ways that I identify? And what are some of the ways, maybe even, that I suffer around trying to make the role work, or make that self or version of myself work? So another theme that's very related is the theme of separateness. I call this suffering from self and other. If there's a role or a self that's created, there tends to be an other that gets created at the same time. And so this is where dualism opens up, and I'll try to break this down. It doesn't have to be so philosophical in nature, but basically there are power dynamics in every position that we hold. I wasn't invited as a part of the popular group in middle school. There was a self that I, and there was an other, right? The other group I wasn't fitting into. There was a separation of that self and the other. Politics, we see self and other all the time. It's not about right and wrong, it's just about the dynamic that when you identify as liberal, you make a stance that you're not. When you identify as conservative, that's a stance. It otherizes the opposing, the other selves. You see, it opens up a separateness. And so mostly, I don't see this as being too much of a problem, because we have to have roles, and we have to vote, right? But where we really want to, and where I think the Buddha encouraged us to take this on as a practical, as a actual practice, is to look at the power dynamics that develop between groups. We want popularity, we crave praise, we want status, we knowingly and unknowingly exclude others through roles, oppress others, dismiss others. I like the word, which I never used to like, is one of the most traditional words of what we're waking up from is ignorance, which I used to really disdain because I found it belittling and I didn't quite understand it, but I like reframing that as ignorance. All of the ways that we ignore, we tend to not have to pay attention to the others because they're not in our direct view. So it's not about bad or wrong or should be or could be doing it better or different. It's just about there's an opportunity for more inquiry and more investigation into these dynamics. One of the main dynamics that opens up here also is divisiveness. When we take a position, like I said earlier, we lose sight of the interconnectedness and the similarities, and the Buddha would say this really deep intention that all human beings have is just really to be safe, to be protected from harm. I want to read a quote by a Buddhist scholar, a guy named Stephen Batchelor, who talks about this broader sense of anatta, not self. He says, he's a little bit more crass and rude than I am, I think, but he says, "People are blinded to the fundamentally unpredictable and insecure nature of their existence by attachment to their place." He defines place. He says, "One's place is that to which one is most strongly bound. It is the foundation on which the entire edifice of one's identity is built. It is formed through identification with a physical location and a social position, by one's religious and political beliefs, through that instinctive conviction of being a solitary self, ego. One's place is where one stands and where one takes a stand against everything that seems to challenge what is mine. This stance is your posture vis-a-vis the world. It encompasses everything that lies on this side of the line that separates you from me." delight in it creates a sense of being fixed and secure in the midst of an existence that is anything but fixed and secure. Loss of it, one fears, would mean that everything one cherishes would be overwhelmed by chaos, meaninglessness, or madness. And so the Buddhist teaching is not that you do not have a self, but that you are a self in process. Your self is a verb, not a noun. Clinging to the self puts a box around it and creates suffering, the suffering of self and others. So as a reflective practice, if you look back on your life, it's actually quite practical. You can look and you can even contemplate and think, how many versions of yourself have there been throughout your life? Have your political identities changed? Your family roles? Has your professional identity changed? Your music tastes? Your hobbies? And then what are the current? What are your current? What is my current role and relationship? How are they changing? In what ways do I suffer about my self-identity? What do I believe about myself and who I am? Do we notice that? That's a huge part of the self. Self-criticism. Who's the judge in there? Who says? Who says I'm not doing so good or I could do better? Who says I'm weird or awkward? Who says I don't look thin enough? Have we ever questioned and thought to think and reflect, whose voice is that? What is that? So we're trying to touch into and hold and care for the vulnerability of being alive and the changing nature of our place in the world and the uncertainty that the self ordinarily keeps and leaps up to protect. And so now I want to talk about the more subtle, for fear of going over a lot of heads, and mine included, we'll go for it. And this is where the five aggregates come in. I'm a visual person. So that's four things. I didn't write one up there, which is consciousness, and we'll talk about it. We'll kind of comb through it. So the teaching on anatta is that there is no part of your current experience that you can point to as me. There's no part of you that is fully you. What are you? Are you your body? Are you your body? Then look in the mirror. Do you feel like your body changes, right? It doesn't quite look like it used to. Oftentimes you get older and you look in the mirror and you don't feel much older. What is age anyway, right? So, you know, that's probably one of the easiest ways that we identify. I identify with this body. And so in the practical sense, let's keep it practical. Yes, I'm Andrew. I'm not going to talk about my body in the third person, right? I have a body. This is me here, sitting here. We want to be grounded in that. That's real. That's a conventional truth. It's a very normal and important part of existence. But what the Buddha is pointing towards is this subtler practice at looking at the fact that there's no part of us that's inherently me and permanently me. So a Buddhist scholar writes and talks about this, and we'll unpack this. He uses his big words and terminology. So what are you? What we conventionally call a person can be understood in terms of the five aggregates, the sum of which must not be taken for a permanent identity, since beings are nothing but an amalgam of ever-changing experiences, phenomena. Without a thorough understanding of the five aggregates, we cannot grasp the liberation process at work within the individual who is, after all, simply an amalgam of the five aggregates. So what does that mean? So we already talked about the body, material form. This is called rupa in Pali Sanskrit. The process of the five aggregates is easily summarized as nama rupa. So we're a thinking body process. Right, so that's simple enough. We're a thought-body process. We have a mind, and that's happening. We have a body, and that's changing and happening. In the material form, you have the elements of the physical world. So we have atoms. We have all of these. I'm not a science person, but we have all of the genetic makeup, and we have all of the matter that makes up the body. Within the body, we have sense organs. We have eyes, ears, nose, tongue, the full nervous system body. We have also the mind, which is a sensing organ. And then out here in the world, and even in here, we have sense objects. We have objects that we can sense. So we're not born into a vacuum. I think of, like, has anyone been to Float in Nashville, like the sensory deprivation tank? We have sensory objects, right? We're experiencing sights and sounds and smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts, for that matter. So something I'm not going to go deep into is the thing that makes all of this work and come to life in our experience is consciousness. And consciousness, the best thing to say about consciousness is how it works, which is it's a subject-object relationship. So you have a brain, and when you're awake, because you're awake, everything's turned on, and you experience the world because you have sense organs and you have consciousness. Because sense objects can come into consciousness through seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, smelling consciousness, tasting consciousness, feeling consciousness, and thinking consciousness. So you make contact with the world through thinking, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling. It's basically, everyone follow so far? We make contact with the world through our senses. And in Buddhism, there's a sixth sense, which is the thought, thinking. Thinking is the sixth sense because it generates a lot of stuff, emotions, more thoughts, right? Thinking is also something to be experienced. Based on what we make contact with in the world, we have a sensing nervous system, we have our perception, our memory. And so we have a primary sense of likes or dislikes that's registered at the nervous system level. This is what in Buddhism we would call vedana, or feeling tone. Everything that you can put your attention on in any given experience has some type of felt experience of pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, neutral. And so the good news about the Buddha's Dharma is that the feelings are not that confusing. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. And we develop conditioned responses to pain and pleasure. In neuroscience, they would call this the pain-pleasure dichotomy. So we're born into a world that's stressful because we experience both pain and pleasure. And pain and pleasure are somewhat unpredictable. And we try to predict them and control them and create the comfortable conditions. But ultimately, we have to experience pain and pleasure. We like pleasure. We crave pleasure. We hold on to pleasure. And we push away and avoid and dislike pain. And over time, you go throughout the world, you start to store certain experiences, people, places, identities, roles, things that we perceive as pleasant or unpleasant, and we avoid the ones that we don't like, and we go after and cling to and hold to the ones we do like. There's a big interconnection between feeling and perception. Perception is where we get into a lot of trouble. It's very important because I wouldn't know what the hell I'm doing right now if I didn't have perceptive memory, but I know, okay, I'm at against the stream, I'm supposed to be talking about something, I have something prepared, I have some of that stored in my memory, I have some notes, right? Perception enables me to function. It's what allows us to drive a car. But a lot of the things that we store in our procedural memory, in our perceptive memory, are inaccurate. are biased, are very opinionated, and we react and live from, we're inclined to take a stance. This is what I call the to-do mind, comes in and takes a stance and moves us into more thought, speech, and action, which is what we would call karma, based upon how we feel and how we perceive something. Does that make sense? So this is where the self and the inclination to become a self really starts to solidify. We take a position because of how we feel and how we perceive it. So let me give an example for where this can cause a lot of trouble. Remember, I gave an example recently about the wolf that I saw on retreat. So maybe I'll use a different one. I work with people every day. I'm a social worker, so I see probably hundreds. I think I've approximated probably about 150 different people in some group therapy form or individual form in 1 week. And one of the things that tends to happen because of my experience, my procedural, my memory, is that I very quickly can kind of judge certain types of clients, how motivated they are by their body language and what they say. So it's not uncommon for me to be inclined to want to get out of working with people that I don't like or that I perceive as unmotivated or... One example is actually before I worked in therapy, but a similar example of this is I had a friend, before he was my friend, an acquaintance that I met in a math class at Belmont when I was in school several years ago. And he came up to me, he had a fish shirt on. I don't know if y'all know who fish is, but it basically means you're a pothead. And I was in recovery. I was new in recovery. I had gone through my whole... upbringing, abusing, using drugs and alcohol pretty severely, pretty hard, hardcore fashion. And so I stopped that, and for 6 months I'd been clean, and I met this guy, and he came up to me, actually went to the restroom, and he went to the restroom at the same time. And he came up to me, and he was like, hey man, how's it going? I'm Matt. And I was like, what's up, Matt? Nice to meet you. I'm Andrew. And I said, oh, do you listen to Fish? I used to listen to him quite a bit. And he said, yeah. And he said, do you smoke? Right? So I was like, see, I knew it. My perception was right. And I said, no, actually, I'm in recovery, and I've been in recovery. I said, do you know what that is? And he was like, oh, yeah, my dad's been in for a while. Come to find out, his dad had been sober for 35 years and was one of the counselors at the treatment center I went to, but we didn't have that conversation yet. And so, I didn't talk to this guy. I stayed away from him because he wasn't, I'm not going to hang around someone that's getting high. I see him come into a 12-step meeting weeks, maybe a couple months later. I almost didn't recognize him because I wasn't very close, but I saw him, and one of the things that they incline you to do, a learned behavior that we practice and learn in 12-step recovery, is to be of service and to reach out to people that are new. But I had the perception, this kid's a stoner, he's probably coming here because he got in trouble. A lot of people don't stick around in recovery. I've been clean now for 11 years, and I know way more people that have not stayed clean than that have. And so all of this bias and view that I had, and the self that I created for him of who he was and where he was at. But something in my mind, this kind of volition, came up, and I remembered, okay, practice. I'm supposed to practice. Mindfulness, right, came up, and I remembered, oh, I'm supposed to practice service. And so he left the group, and I was hesitant. I don't know if I want to talk to him, if I want to go greet him, or it's awkward for me. I don't want to feel uncomfortable, unpleasant. But I said, fuck it, I'll do it. And so I ran up the stairs. I remember I ran. He had already went down the street like a block, and I ran after him like a crazy person. I said, hey, Matt. And I gave him a hug, because that's what we do in NA, is you give people a hug, which is very weird if you don't come. And so he was like taken aback, and it was very awkward. And I said, hey, here, take my number. This is what we do here. Give me a call, whatever. And so a few days go by and he doesn't call. And I was like, I'm not going to call him. He doesn't want to come. I his self was created. I know how people are. He's just trying it out or something happened. He doesn't want to hear from me. But I had this inclination. I was like, you know what? Screw it. Like, I should push this and see what's here. I'm just going to call him. What the heck? I had that inclination. And so I practiced and I called him up and he answered. And he said, you know, it's weird you called. I was just thinking about getting high. I'd been clean for 4 days. And I was like, well, do you want to? What's up? How have you been? And he started telling me more about himself, and we got off the phone. And, you know, 11 years later, this is one of my best friends, right? And it all comes from questioning the self, practicing against the constraints in the house. Sometimes the Buddha calls the self the housemaker, breaking free of the confines of the house and pushing ourselves to reevaluate our views, our perceptions, and the perceptions of our roles and who we are and who others are. The reason why I introduced the aggregates is because the Buddha's Dharma is very expansive. He wasn't encouraging people to take things on blind belief. The word that he used is ehipasiko, which is to see for yourself. Opanayiko, to see for yourself, to investigate yourself. What we want to look at is the ways that our relationship, our feelings, conditioned behavior, our views and perceptions, conditioned behavior, how we're inclined to take a stance very quickly, how we feel threatened, we feel the inclination of the body to protect, to dismiss, to disengage with eye contact, to exclude people with our speech, to harm people with our behavior, and how the self plays really a central role oftentimes in a lot of our suffering. And so in meditation practice, and we'll, as we go through the time when we get to the path factor of mindfulness, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, we'll talk about exploring the aggregates as a practice. A formal sitting meditation practice, walking meditation practice. And so I think that's about it. I know that's a lot. And so hopefully, the invitation is just to have some discussion. It doesn't have to be any expert opinion on any concepts, but any interest that you have in sharing about your experience of this idea of the self and suffering around our roles or identities, any questions or comments you may have. So we'll leave it open for some discussion and dialogue. Thank you.
Should feeling and perception be connected?
Yeah. So these are called, and I didn't really talk about it a lot, the aggregates are actually what the aggregates, the term is khanda, and what the khandas are is they're bundles or piles. So these are rupa, material form, which is where you make contact, feeling, perception, sankhara, which I have defined as inclination, and consciousness. And these things, consciousness is essential for the other four to arise, but the other four arise in a moment's experience. So as you make contact, that's a moment of consciousness. And when that happens, feeling, perception, inclination, it all arises. And inclination is largely influenced by our habits, patterns. So there's bodily inclination, there's emotional inclinations and mental inclinations that we have, and of course behaviors become patterns over time. So sometimes the best way to look at this is to start at the gross forms and look at the subtle, like we did. Look at our behaviors. right? And so we look at our roles in the world and how the self's created in the world. And then you can start to look back and what thoughts actually led to those behaviors. And the more that you practice mindfulness and insight practice, you can actually start to see more how feelings and perceptions condition our inclinations and how our past experiences inform our current. Yeah. So it's all, you're completely right. Perception and feeling, they collide. Yeah. And so the Buddha says you're not any one of these things. You're a changing bundle, basically. But memory makes it real hard because we feel like we are. We feel like there's some self. But when you try to find it, which one is it? You know, what memory or what version of myself am I? Yeah.
I like bringing some structure